Les séminaires du Collège de France.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Welcome back. It is really a great, great honor and a great pleasure and privilege to be here amongst you. And I must begin by extending, first of all, my most sincere gratitude and thanks, and my warmest thanks to Mika Bal for this generous introduction and this generous invitation to share in this space with her today, and to respond a little bit to her third event in this lecture seminars. To be invited by Mika Bal to participate in a project or a dialogue is always to be invited to think beyond the boundaries of one's own thought, to experiment, to think creatively in response to problems that matter, real problems, and embark, in her words, on a journey, an adventure of thought. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity and for an opportunity that is one of continuing a dialogue that we've had for some time now. And I was it was so exciting to be able to work with Mika on the book that she spoke about in this series, which you introduced so generously. Thank you. I must also thank today the Collège de France. It is a really sincere double pleasure to be here, to be able to speak here at this venerable institution whose intellectual history has been such an inspiration. Thank you to Camille Isnard for her help in organizing the event today and setting up the translation, and of course to the wonderful translation team who are working hard as I speak. So what I would like to attempt in this short intervention is to offer a response to Mika Bal's lecture that teases out and restages some of its claims and concepts and the interstices between them, whilst exploring what might happen when we extend or reshape some of their parameters and horizons. So rather than a set of questions or direct responses to what she's spoken about today, my aim is somewhat to construct a more indirect problematization, which might suggest an atmosphere, I hope, of recurrence with difference. In this sense, it may be that I am enacting a type of quotationalism, as Mika has set out in this lecture, and this would be very much a testament to the regard in which I hold her work and its continuing example. I wish to start this interchange with Mika Bal with a focus on the question of the inter, rather than the terms that are related through it, such as media or culture, language or discipline. Taking off from Bal's concept of the intership, as that which, I quote Bal, brings together all activities qualified with the preposition inter, from interdisciplinary to intertextual, from intermedial to intercultural, and where each noun newly casts or refracts the sense of the preposition inter, I want to consider what is at stake in the experience and the address of the inter, in thinking interstitially about the interstice, where the interstice is a gap between things, and what I call interstitial thinking is thinking that begins with the experience of things in between, or the zone in between, those things we don't recognize, the differential zones and blind spots within our field of perception, and an investment of such experiences as conditions of inquiry and the production of new ideas and ways of thinking. Rather than locating or attributing what I call interstitiality, or the condition of being between, as Mika Bal has called it, to in or to things, situations or objects, a process which can quickly lead to what she has called fixations of identity and essentialism, to take today's problematic pairing, the questions of culture or medium, for example, I think that what is most fertile about the interstitial is its access to such attribution or citing, and in turn its deranging and mobilizing impact on the terms with which it is conjoined. That is, interstitiality challenges how we think about the identity of media or culture, language or discipline. So rather than attempt to define one type of practice as intermedial and another as not, we might instead ask ourselves with Bal, who is of course herself a pioneer of interstitial thinking, her work constantly ranging between and across disciplines, across chronological and geographical boundaries, to prize apart the spaces between, we might ask ourselves with her whether all media might be seen as intermedial. And likewise, might not interculturalism too be a condition or experience of betweenness rather than a defining attribute of certain environments, histories, or discourses? From addressing the stakes and the senses of interstitial thinking, we will be able to offer a few remarks on the affinities between intermediality and interculturality. For there is no correlative or definitive relation binding these two terms. The intermedial is not always intercultural. The intercultural is clearly not always intermedial. What links them and gives to them their common effects and their potency is their interstitiality, their condition of betweenness. In its distinction from multi, intra, or trans, the preposition inter has to do with the potency of difference in itself. In distinction, perhaps, to the many things of the multi, the internality of the intra, or the across of the trans. Interstitial thinking is not about collating lots of different points of view or bypassing them in favor of a perspective that traverses them, but rather of affirming the interval, l'écart, as a site of fecundity, of potential. Interstitiality posits itself against the identitarianism that will always take the side of one or another. And I am taking the notion of difference in itself here from Gilles Deleuze, who once described his own philosophical project, he describes in the preface to Difference and Repetition, as to think difference in itself independently of the forms of representation that reduce it to the same, to register an intense world of differences that disturbs the structures that support thought's recognition of itself and its objects. From the interstitial perspective, familiar and recognizable things, that is, things made familiar or recognizable with respect to given contexts or frames of reference, which may be medial, linguistic, disciplinary, and cultural, and other, indeed, are all made strange. In inquiring about how the interstice, or in her words, the being between, might be accessed or produced, Mika Bal places us straight away in the terrain of art. So this is what I will be focusing on. Artistic practices invent ways of inhabiting or mobilizing the interstice, experimenting with relationality and difference in ways that inspire the traveling of thought. Echoing and extending Bal's intuitions, I would like to suggest that a good test site for further probing the relations between intermediality and interculturality today is the topic of world or global art and its study. This topic, one of the most topical and heated questions continually in the study of art and images, exposes the historical intersections of intermediality and interculturality in the field of art practice and discourse since the late 1970s. On the one hand, the widespread challenge to what the American art critic Clement Greenberg's famous idea of medium purity or specificity, the claim that all artistic media could be understood in terms of their essential specificity, that which made them one media rather than another, and that in turn modernist arts foregrounded this specificity, such that painting, of course, emphasizes its flatness. And this challenge intersects, chronologically, that is, first with the globalization of contemporary art, its production and its reception across global networks and markets that disrupted or challenged this hegemony of Western metropolitan centers, and with the expansion and rethinking of the discipline of art history in terms of world art studies within the Anglo-American Academy. By probing this intersection, I hope to further refract and tease out one dimension of Mika Bal's interrogations of artists such as Doris Salcido and Nalini Malani and her theory of quotation. The question of world or global art and its study concerns the question of how we can address the arts and cultures of the world, past and present. This in turn prompts a series of fundamental inquiries about the address of difference and of diversity within an expanded field, such as how can we construct ways of seeing that neither fracture into multiple locals nor reconstitute ostensibly universal or, in fact, all-seeing points of view? How can we affirm approaches that challenge centrism whilst not reinstating any points of view as dominant? For me, it is this question of perspective, how to register and think difference whilst not collapsing difference into endless diversity or reductive general or generalizing categories or concepts, that is really the most one of the most important stakes of the question. Whether the initial problematic is world, global, or most recently, in fact, planet, and we will probably speak a little bit about this later. The British art historian John Anions, who was pivotal to the emergence of world art studies in Britain at the University of East Anglia, where he also helped shape the Sainsbury Centre for Visual Arts, and who has pioneered since then, recent times, the integration of neuroscience into art historical thinking, once remarked that from a world perspective, a portrait in oils is as strange as a New Guinean ritual mask. That European art becomes strange and puzzling when seen through this panoramic lens. What interests me is that instead of comparativism, which is always in some way or other reductive, what is common here is strangeness. World art presents itself, John Anions writes, articulates, as a relational project for which new schemas to make sense of or give coherency to the diverse relations between things, practices, languages, and cultures are often sought. Anions chose geography as the new schema for this project, the Atlas of World Art, a vast collective mapping of the artistic and cultural productions of the world. This work and the inquiries it catalyzed have been important in recalibrating hierarchies and reinforcing the limitations and redundancies of such dualisms and binaries as West and non-West, global and local, and so on, within the way we think about art and images. To move from art historical to geographical thought, or what has been called the geohistory of art, is to see European cultures as decentered within the world, and affirm the notion famously expressed by the historian Dipesh Chakrabarty that thought is always related to place. But this does not mean that thought is reducible to place. And the experience, and I should add thought, of difference is of course not simply a geographical question. Empirical cartographies surely can't go far enough. How can the Atlas account for all those passages, those interstices between one map and the next, one snapshot and the next, between one region or period and another? So here, the two adjacent maps of China and Tibet, world art and culture in China and Tibet between 1300 and 1500, are two discrete snapshots, two images of this moment. And the question is, how do we capture what lies between these snapshots, beyond the borders of the map, in fact? Or how do we account for recurrences, for survivals, decays, delays, anachronisms that disturb the cartographic intelligibility, those blind spots that don't offer themselves or enable themselves to be legible to a certain cartographic gaze? The Atlas might map the movement of peoples, materials, objects, and artistic influences via trade routes and migration. It might attend to cross-fertilizations and transitions of styles and symbols, artistic movements or genres. And without a doubt, the study of symbolic forms that was a major vector of the cross-disciplinary inquiries of early 20th century Kunstwissenschaft and indeed Kulturwissenschaft remains an acknowledged element within world and global art study today. But movement is, through its representation, converted to an arrested case. A trade route is as frameable in time and space as a portrait. Categories of geographical area or chronological period restore identity as a means of registering cultural difference and dynamism, and treating difference as a mode of attribution of groups, peoples, or classes of things is an operation through which division is retained or can be retained. Indeed, was it not such categorization of difference that was so controversial in the inaugural exhibition of global contemporary art in the 1989 The Magicians of the Earth, of which the theorist and artist Rashid Arin put it, the binarized concept of the show, on the one hand a modernist avant-garde belonging to European artists, and on the other traditions, folk, indigenous, attributed to non-European peoples, was seen to reinforce inequalities and othering, to use Gayatri Spivak's term, attributed to non-European peoples. Leading to a cultural mummification. Irene here replays Frantz Fanon's terms. What the exhibition overlooked, as he and others argued, was precisely an interstitial category. That category of non-European artists practicing in transnational, modernist, avant-garde, and contemporary idioms and genres. But is identification and representation of the interstice the solution? Whilst Arin's own critical response with his exhibition, The Other Story, of the same year, may have broken with one particular binary, by representing a new category of difference, that is, Asian, African, and Caribbean artists working in post-war Britain, he too ends up mummifying difference in terms of ethnic origin. But isn't to think interstitially, to deterritorialize, to unhinge things from the given semantic context and frameworks of intelligibility through which representation can be staged? Wasn't that how Omi Bhabha developed the notion of the interstitial perspective in his 1994 book, The Location of Culture? He wrote that it is in the emergence of the interstices, the overlap and displacement of domains of difference, that the intersubjective and collective experiences of nationness, community interferences, or cultural value are negotiated. Rather than the representation of difference as a reflection of pre-given ethnic or cultural traits set in, I quote him, the fixed tablet of tradition, and corresponding to the essentialism of multiculturalism as he saw it, subjects are, for Bhabha, formed in between or in excess of the sum of these differential traits. The inter functions as the zone for translations and negotiations. As an example of how such construction can wrest the past from the homogeneous time of tradition and its preservation of originary identity, Bhabha brings our attention to the way in which the African-American artist Renee Green challenged the essentialization of blackness in her site-specific pieces, such as here in her 1990 work, Sites of Genealogy, which used architecture's interstitial spaces to disrupt binary conceptions. And Renee Green used the stairwell in this building as a particular site of problematization between the two levels and their hierarchies of the ground floor and the first floor. So we're brought back here, I think, to Mika Bull's conception of interculturality as the inhabitation of the betweenness of groups traditionally considered to have different cultural identities, which she distinguishes from the type of interculturality based in division that can generate resentment and fears of alterity and its accompanying expressions of hostility or defense. The interstice as a zone of difference in itself, then, demands address as a world beneath the qualitative diversity through which we distinguish things from each other as identities. It demands that we register the way a thing or group differs from itself, and not only how it differs from other things. And this links to what Rosalind Krauss, in the previous slide that I put up, calls the heterogeneity of media in the post-medium age, that media are essentially self-differing. They're differing from themselves internally. Lastly, the encounter with the interstice is not one of recognition, but a disturbance of the given structures that support thought's recognition of itself and its objects, and through this forces thought to think. How can the interstice, as more than what is demarcated between or in relation to existing states, be exposed or constructed? Throughout many of her works, from her 1999 book, Quoting Caravaggio, to her lecture this afternoon, Mika Bal has constantly probed the potential of quotation, specifically what she calls quotationalism, for presenting the interstitial as a zone of interrogation and anachronic production. Quotation takes us beyond any reference to a tablet of tradition. Against the notion of quotation as deferral to an extant authority or as a mode of irony that signals the limits of originality, there is the work of quotation as a set of effects that expose the excess of the source beyond the question of reference. Quotation is often seen as a deliberated tactic or assigned to specific works or movements. But as Ralph Waldo Emerson noted in his famous essay, Quotation and Originality, there is imitation, model, and suggestion everywhere. Famously wary of the modern preoccupation with speaking through others as a way of a form of legitimation, Emerson nevertheless acknowledged how quotation could in fact reveal the inventiveness of the writer through their acts of selection and reassemblage. Two centuries later, this characterization recurs in the guise of what Julia Kristeva, in the wake of Mikhail Bakhtin, articulated under the name of the intertextual, that condition, in her words, where each text becomes a mosaic of quotations, absorptions, and transformations of others. In her lecture this afternoon, Bal considered how such a media product, in her words, resists and frustrates the art historical methods, such as iconography, that attempt to stabilize quotations' interstitial effects. And this is one expression of the tension between interstitial and disciplinary thought. Emerson's view that the past is for us, but only an inventor knows how to borrow, returns in the artist Martha Rosler's remark in her 1982 text, Notes on Quotes, that the separation between quotes and quotation calls attention to expression as a garment and invites judgment of its cut. This technique was, in Rosler's view, an enabler for the resuscitation of forgotten or disparaged works that could fuel liberated possibilities for feminist practice. It is memorialization that Bal emphasizes in her reading of Doris Salcedo's magisterial work, Palimpsest. To the quotation of names forgotten refugees, the intermedial interstices between water, stone, and sand is inextricable, a sign perhaps of the palimpsestic quality of quotation itself, as you said, forever appearing and disappearing, concealing and revealing, but in this process, concentrating the source. Quotation here, quotationalism, is a site where literary analysis and art history meets the philosophy of history and historical time, becoming a mean of rebuilding history in redemptive ways, a possibility that had, of course, been famously acknowledged by Walter Benjamin, whom, as Hannah Arendt put it, discovered that the transmissibility of the past as authority, as tradition, as something to preserve, had in modernity been replaced by its citability. In his much cited Convolute N of the Arcades Project, Benjamin wrote that this work has to develop to the highest degree the art of citing without quotation marks. Quotation then becomes the tearing out of context with its destructive effects. It produces a thought fragment that blasts the continuum of history, at once exposing the difference within the source and concentrating that which repeats differently each time. In Ball's words, quotation enables an intertemporality, a type of anachronism or preposterous history that actively intervenes in history, complicating the idea of precedent as origin. As she says in the opening of her book of the same name, quoting Caravaggio changes his work forever. And we might add, it also changes the subject, the name of the subject who quotes. His quotation of a self-portrait in the Night Watches is a moment at which the objectification of history transforms or transmogrifies into a subjective discourse. The inventive and interventionist quotation without context is quite different from the dreary academic mania for citation that precisely knows or proves that we know our context and the limitations of our own originality. Instead, a shifting or transplantation of elements or traits of a thing from one time and place to another, quotation functions as a mode of interstitial thinking par excellence, a technique of displacement, intervention, renewal and construction that can take on intermedial, intercultural, interlingual, interspatial, and intertemporal dimensions. It is intervention and invention that impels the quotational acts running from Salcedo's palimpsest to the artist Shiran Neshat's quotations of Iranian feminist poets and writers within her self-portraits in the Women of Allah series. From Otagawa Sadahide's quotation of European portraiture within a Yokohama print to Edward Munch's quotations of the Adam and Eve scene. Through all these cases of interstitial thinking, quotation shows itself as acts of repetition with difference, with a reciprocal deranging impact on the terms, reminding us that the inter is not just between, but reciprocal. For example, the Yokei quotation of a European tradition that renders both cultures, both traditions, strange. So here, the peculiar oversized portrait, which could be a window frame, the European faces taking on traits of Yokioi stylization, that distinction between the image and the Japanese text and style of writing, is less a strategy by which a cultural terrain is reclaimed or asserted than a construction impelled by an experience of strangeness and the emergence of an interstitial zone with its polyphonous registers of sense. This work, a woodblock print, becomes intermedial in its quotation of the European oil painting tradition. Made in Japan, it nevertheless produces intercultural effects, and the interstice is sustained as a place of strangeness, not one of intelligibility or identification. Can scholarship affirm interstitial thought, taking encounters with difference as the occasion for disrupting inherited habits? Of exploring the gap between China and the West, François Julien has remarked that I do not do so to construct separate worlds and make China serve the role of the other, but rather as a means to return to the unthought, that on the basis of which we think and which as a result we do not think. The encounter with difference offers itself as the occasion to stand back from one's own mind, to shift normative habits of thought, to become unstuck from the things that make us cohere and to reconfigure the field of the thinkable as a common but differentiated zone. Zigzagging between one site and another through acts of translation, through the creation of extraordinary words, through writing itself. This destabilizes terms and categories such as the nude, such as the landscape, producing a new reciprocal scrutiny and holding in tension that which has been separated, whilst exposing the heterogeneity of every culture. Many scholars have, however, pointed out the incompatibility between the desire for thinking across frontiers, the embrace of interstitiality, with academic structures of knowledge, such as specialism, or in the case of world and global art, the organization of faculties into chronogeographical compartments of period and region. Mika Bal has, throughout her work, not only remarked on this tension, but has also made the tension a site of creation and inquiry that prizes open yet further interstices for study. Interstitial thought is an attitude, it's an ethos, it's an approach. The interstitial thinker is asked to be a perpetual beginner, to displace themselves from what they know, to suspend expertise and embrace being an outsider to a field, continually looking around the corner, becoming a foreigner in one's own language. To conceptualize the interstice as that which is unthought within thought, outside the images of thought through which we already think, is to think without referring to a position already within the world from which to think. In the words of Gilles Deleuze, again, once one steps outside what's been thought before, once one ventures outside what's familiar and reassuring, and one has to invent new concepts for unknown lands, then thinking becomes, as Foucault puts it, a perilous act, a violence whose first victim is oneself. And we can perhaps note here Foucault's own remarks on the history of the commonplace book, the function of collecting quotations and other hypomemata, which for the ancient Greeks included aphorisms, sections of texts, and other fragments and notes, not to understand the meaning of the original source, less to do so, but to construct a new set of propositions for oneself in a shaping of the self. This attitude of the construction of an intellectual milieu is what Mika Bal has cultivated and renewed throughout her own extraordinary adventures of thought. To close this intervention with one work which I have found a particularly moving testimony to interstitial thinking, and that is Shirin Nashat's 1999 film Soliloquy. This double screen video projection explores, in the artist's word, exilic identity. The two videos are projected on opposite walls, facing each other, usually within an enclosed space. A woman in a hijab, Nashat herself, takes parallel journeys through two cultural landscapes. In one, she is in an unidentified Middle Eastern city, we imagine somewhere in Iran, the country of her birth. In the other, she is in a Western metropolis, we imagine the United States, where she emigrated to begin her study as an artist. The two videos, the two Nashats, are in dialogue with each other. Where one moves, the other stops and watches. And the viewer in turn must look back and forth across the two different worlds, across an irreducible interstice, a space of becoming. As Nashat has said, the work is an expression of living in a state of the in-between. Intermediality and interculturality emerge as effects of the work's interstitial thinking here. Its interrogation, rather than representation, of identification, as in Bal's words, an act, a choice, and a voyage. Today, the question of interstitial thinking constantly assumes new senses and potentials, refracting ever further. Interrogations of the intermedial and the intercultural are put into dialogue with the questions of the interspecial and the interplanetary. The stakes of ensuring interstitial zones are nourished within academies is vital against the objectives of identity politics for partial and therefore potentially divisive forms of recognition. The question of interstitial thinking becomes urgent as an experience of difference that does not submit difference as a trope for affirming division. Art and what Mika Bell has called the living cultures of visual images continue to have a vital role in reminding us of this horizon of possibility. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.